May I have your attention, please? We're going to have a little change in the schedule. We have the Samuel Chase Award presentation this year, and to do the presenting, may I introduce Doug McNeil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you all hear me in the back? As most of you know, the Samuel Chase Award is the highest honor that the Maryland Libertarian Party can bestow. We don't give the award every year, but we have lately because we found so many worthy recipients. I was asked to talk a little bit about Samuel Chase. Some years ago, I gave a talk entitled, Who is Samuel Chase and Why Did We Name an Award After Him? I can't repeat it all here because Chase's accomplishments were so many that it takes half an hour just to list them all. But briefly, Samuel Chase was a Marylander. He was a Revolutionary War figure and a signer of the Declaration of Independence. Chase played a very important role in bringing the Revolution to Maryland, and during the war, he worked tirelessly and effectively for the cause of independence. And after the war, he dominated the Maryland legislature for many years as the leader of Maryland's upper house, which was the predecessor to the Maryland State Senate. And later, President Washington appointed him as an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, which he held until his death in 1811. As much as Chase did, what he's really remembered for is not anything that he did, but something that was done to him. Namely, he was impeached. He was the first and I believe the only U.S. Supreme Court justice who was ever impeached. Thomas Jefferson was the president, and Jefferson didn't like that Chase had been an anti-federalist, but then after the Constitution was adopted, he became a federalist, switching sides. And Jefferson didn't like the way Chase was ruling, so he arranged for the House to have him impeached. There was some justice to a few of the charges, but most of them were bogus. It was just a way to get rid of him. So they had the trial in the Senate, and Chase was acquitted on all charges. There were a few charges that actually got a majority vote to convict, but the Constitution requires two-thirds for conviction, so he was acquitted on all charges. And this whole affair left a very bad taste in everybody's mouth, including Jefferson, so it was never tried again. Since Chase's acquittal, many judges have been impeached and convicted and removed from office. It was always for actual misconduct or unfitness. Never again was it just, we don't like the way he's ruling, and so we want to get him out and put somebody else in. And Chase's acquittal established the principle of judicial independence, that judges are free to rule any way they want, however their judgment tells them. Now, if you look at it's instructive to look at the Constitution of the old Soviet Union. You'll find there people have all these rights. It says so right here. But, of course, people in the Soviet Union had no rights at all. There was no Soviet judge who ever found any act by the executive to be illegal. If they had, they would have been removed from office and sent to the gulag. So they had no independent judiciary, and therefore they had no rights. So judicial independence is in the Constitution, but it was really Chase's trial that established the principle as a fact. It was not unlike the trial earlier of the acquittal of Peter Zenger on charges of seditious libel, which established the principle of freedom of the press and also the power of juries to nullify the law, which we still enjoy today. Chase is not remembered as a great libertarian theorist. He is he's not a Madison or a Jefferson in that respect. He's more like a Washington. It was not what he said or wrote. It was his actions, what he did, that he's remembered for. And that's what we'd like to give the award for the persons whose work has done the most to advance the cause of liberty in Maryland. By our tradition, the award is granted by a consensus of the previous award winners. And by our tradition, the physical award is always a silver coin, which I happen to have here with me. And I think this year's coin is a particularly handsome coin. It's a called a silver eagle dollar. It is with the famous Walking Liberty design on it. The obverse shows a woman in a long flowing dress representing liberty, carrying a sheaf of wheat representing prosperity, walking toward the rising sun representing the future. This is 1 ounce of fine silver, and it's a beautiful coin. It's widely thought this is one of the most beautiful coin designs the United States has ever come up with. It's also a legal tender coin. It has a face value of $1, so it serves as a reminder of just how much our money would be worth if they had followed the Constitution and only allowed gold or silver to be legal tender. They have inflated about 98% of the value out of the dollar. So this is the physical award, but the real award is the respect and admiration of his fellow libertarians. That's really what this is all about. So, and by our tradition, our deliberations are always kept confidential so that no one except the previous winners who have participated in the discussion know who this year's winner is. Not even this year's winner knows that he or she has already won the award. So my job as the award presenter is to extol the many virtues of this year's award winner while leaving everyone in the dark as to who it is for as long as possible. That's always hard, but I'll try. This year's award winner has not been active in the party for all that long, really only a few years. And this person ran for public office as a nominee of the Libertarian Party, put together a good campaign that even got some small amount of national press attention, and did pretty well even though he was not elected. But that's not why this person got the award. By way of background, as you probably know, we had a little trouble getting on the ballot last year. We needed 10,000 valid petition signatures, so we turned in 15,000 roughly, and the state invalidated two-thirds of them under a new rule, leaving us thousands short. So at that point, we were stuck. I mean, the purpose of a political party is to run candidates for public office, and if you can't get your candidates on the ballot, you know, you're dead as a political party. So we didn't know what we were going to do. But then one person stepped forward and took the case, and we talked the Maryland Green Party into joining us as co-plaintiffs in the lawsuit, because they were in exactly the same situation that we were in. And to make a long story short, we won that case, and judge ordered both the Maryland Libertarian Party and the Maryland Green Party back on the ballot, and we were able to run candidates. This was just in time for the Baltimore City elections. So we ended up running four candidates in that election, and the Green Party ran two. Unfortunately, it's not over yet because the state appealed that decision. And, in fact, the oral arguments were before the Court of Appeals were yesterday. We don't know when they will rule or how they will rule, but No matter how it comes up, there's some things that we have already won. For example, the State Board of Elections no longer disaffiliates our voters. It used to be that every time we would lose political party status, they would take all the registered libertarians and change them all to unaffiliated voters. We managed to convince them that this was pretty clearly illegal, and they no longer do it. They've been doing it for 20 years, as long as I've been around, and they're not going to do it anymore. So there are some things that we've won that are permanent, even if we don't win the appeal. And the person who is most responsible for this big victory, in our opinion, there is no one inside or outside the party who has done more to advance the cause of liberty in Maryland in the last year. And so therefore, it is a distinct privilege of mine to be able to present this year's Samuel Chase Award to our lead attorney, Mark Graff.
Couldn't have done anything in the case without Doug, whose knowledge of election law is second to no one. I'm really tremendously humbled by this, and it was a labor of love. Do I have to get this back if we lose? Good, thank you. But thank you to all of the past award winners. I can't tell you how much this means to me. Thank you very much.
Well deserved.
Okay, we're going to begin the Central Committee meeting. In lieu of the time, Mark, would you have a few minutes to just start off right now to discuss the situation with ballot access, please?
Yes. I'm just going to, is this before or after the meeting for me?
Before. How many people watched, Mark, yesterday on the internet? The Court of Appeals does all their oral arguments are on the internet.
That's okay. The status, I think, Doug covered pretty well. We had an argument yesterday in front of the seven judges of the Maryland Court of Appeals. I think it's safe to say that when the gavel came down at the beginning of the case, we were losing. I hope that we were not losing at the end. But it's very, very difficult to read an appellate court most of the time. And most appellate lawyers will tell you that when you think you know how they're going to rule, watch out, because you sure don't. Based on prior votes, there were at least two of those seven judges that I think, you know, it would take a direct revelation from a higher power to make them vote in our favor. So we needed four of the other five. It's a tall order, but I think we made our case as well as we could, and I think we got a fair hearing and very thoughtful questions from a very active bench. So I am hopeful at this point that we will remain on the ballot. Some of the particularly encouraging signs were that no one asked, for example, you know, what are the time deadlines, how fast do we need to rule? There are a lot of questions that I think you would get if they were worried about how quickly they could throw us off the ballot that no one seemed to want to ask. There was another case after us from Frederick County where Democrats had been frozen out of a charter review process by the dominant Republicans, and that was I think that while the legal arguments there were somewhat different and not entirely I don't think they added much, but the factual context was probably very good for us because it shows that these rules, when they're unfair, when they throw people off the ballot, can bite against the major party voters just as easily as they can against us. So I'm hopeful, and we could know next week. More likely, we could know in 3 or 4 months, and it could be 9 or 10. We just have to sit and wait, and in the meantime, when we get our candidates on the ballot, let's turn the papers in and get them on there, because that's a whole different kettle of fish if the Court of Appeals doesn't rule the way that we like. So, anything else? Any other questions or anything?
how many signatures, if the court finds against us, how many signatures will we collect under the current standards?
One of the many questions that doesn't have an easy answer, but the estimate as of May 5th, when we sort of closed down the factual record of the case, the estimate was that we had about 7,500 signatures. If would have 7,500 if the board recounted certain things that it didn't want to recount until it had to. When we won at the trial court level, the recount was off. We had 12,000 signatures. We won enough of a victory at the trial court level that they didn't even need to count. Everyone realized we had way more than we needed. But I think the most likely result, if we don't win in the Court of Appeals, is we've got to come up with 2,500 more valid signatures. And that probably, given the standards that will be in place, that probably takes picking up 5,000. The one really piece of good news there is that when we first started talking to the board last April, and we asked them, well, look, you know, we're smart people. We can figure out how to beat this name thing. What would happen if we pre-populated the address and name field and just asked people to sign their signature? How about we could go door to door? And, you know, it would be so easy to go down the street of your neighbors and knock on the door, and it's all written out. All they have to do is sign. Everyone's in favor of ballot access. No one's against it. So if you make it easy for people, they'll just sign. We were told flat out, no, that's illegal. Well, now the state, in its argument yesterday, said, we can't understand why these libertarians can't get the same yields out of their signatures that the DREAM Act people got. Well, it's because the DREAM Act people were using a procedure that we were told was illegal. So now the state board has changed its view on computerized pre-populating of signature collection, so we don't have to do it at 20 signatures an hour, as even a pro like Bill gets only 20 an hour. But that means that if we have to come up with 5,000 signatures fast, we can at least use computer technology to try and do that. So.
Any questions?
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.